Welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording July 10th, 2020, we're going to be talking to our fellow Eugene Lang and Ian Brody, who's previously our program director, about Canada's fiscal snapshot, which was released this week, and the impact that that might have on the government of Canada's finances and national defense in particular. Gene is also an adjunct professor with the School of Policy Studies at Queen's University, and he is a longtime staffer and as well as being chief of staff to ministers of national defense in the Cochin and Martin governments. Ian Brody was Prime Minister Stephen Harper's first chief of staff and is now a professor at the University of Calgary, who until recently was on leave as an advisor to opposition leader Andrew Scheer. Gene, Ian, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Good to be here, Dave.
So we originally had scheduled this podcast to have a discussion about a piece that Gene had written for us a couple of weeks ago titled RIPSSC, which is basically looking at the future going forward for defense in the fiscal environment. But that in some cases, I think, has been superseded fairly significantly by the release a couple of days ago of the government economic snapshot, laying out the fiscal situation Canada's in right now, as well as the economic situation that the country's in. So we're going to come back to kind of the particulars of the argument that you were laying out, Gene. But to my mind, the snapshot on Wednesday just magnified the potential circumstance that you were outlining. So, Gene, can you start us off just by giving your take on what was released on Wednesday and what the key takeaways there are?
Sure. Well, when I read this fiscal snapshot, I guess I could sum it up in more or less in two words: unprecedented and uncertainty. We have unprecedented drop in economic output. We have unprecedented rise in unemployment in a very short span of time, and we have the largest peacetime deficit. So, you know, you just can't get much more grim than that. And the other theme that really runs through that whole document, and I think you don't really need that document to know this, is the theme of uncertainty. Economists really don't know where the economy is going, and therefore it's very hard for governments to know where their finances are going. I have some sympathy for the argument that, you know, they haven't laid out a multi-year projections. I mean, I can respect some of the criticisms of that as well, but it is, you know, an unprecedentedly uncertain environment because so much of it is dependent on the behavior and path of viral infection we really don't know very much about. So to me, that's the kind of the two watchwords in the government's so-called snapshot.
Ian, what's your take?
I may agree with Eugene's two-word assessment here. I guess what surprised me about the snapshot, three things that surprised me with the snapshots. They're basing their projection on about a 7 or 8% shrink in the size of the economy this year. That strikes me as being probably optimistic. Next year, after this 7 or 8% shrink of the economy, next year they're projecting 5 or 6% growth in the economy, which means, you know, it'll be more than a year before we get back to where we were in February on economic activity. And so that those two pieces together, you know, I mean, they don't sound like eye-opening numbers, but they are eye-opening numbers. The only thing that matters when you're doing the big picture of a federal budget is the size of GDP growth or shrink. And a shrink of 8% it makes for a very difficult picture. And after that, growth of 5% on the smaller base means you've got a very difficult at least two or three years coming here. But what I also was surprised, you know, it's an opportunity for them to sort of turn the page on the kind of COVID honeymoon that the government's been having for the past couple of months of these sort of daily press conferences and spraying money to everybody to try and help them through. And there was just nothing there to show that the government had spent any time thinking about what the recovery out of this thing is going to look like. They may have thought this through. There may be some plan somewhere. But if there is, they gave no indication of it. So, you know, the uncertainty that Gene talks about coming from the uncertain path of a virus we don't really know that much about is compounded by the fact that government has given no indication that it has a plan or even the beginnings of a framework for thinking about how you come out of this thing economically.
Yeah, and just let me emphasize one point that Ian makes there on the drop in output. If they're right, it's about, if they forecast it's going to be just under 7%. If they're right about that, just to put that in context, that's more than twice the drop in output after the 2008-2009 recession, and even more than that, a drop in output as compared to the brutal recession in 1990-91. So it's not just unprecedented here, it's a sort of order of magnitude unprecedented.
And to push on one of the points that you were touching on there, Ian, I guess one of the things that you could draw that if you were to push back on you a little bit, we'd say that, well, they're laying out a much more significant utilization of the wage subsidy going forward as an economic stimulus. But I guess in reading that and then matching it with the projected drop in economic output, my takeaway from seeing that is that the government's going to be involved for quite a long time and quite significantly at any degree of economic activity just to keep people going back to the extent that they can to their regular jobs. And I look at that snapshot and pair it. One of the most striking things to me was the reduction in government revenue. I think it was $70 billion plus under that estimate, under those circumstances, which I would take to be relatively optimistic as well. So the government's got just a massive hole in its revenue picture from this point forward.
Well, this is the problem of the $1.2 trillion debt level, if that's, let's say it's a guess. I wouldn't even say it's much of an estimate. It's just a guess at this stage. And 7% shrink of the economy this year, that's what flows through from this, right? But what does that mean? There's no idea. I don't think the document or the speech gave much of an idea that the government understands that it's going to take a huge effort to get out of this hole. Yes, it looks like the wage subsidy, maybe the CERB benefit are going to continue on here. Trying to get people back to work is now the number one economic priority. Obviously, there's a health dimension to that as well, but all of government economic policy, I think, now has to be focused on getting people back into the workplace as soon as possible, and to get this, lots of brave talk amongst ministers about putting the economy into a medically induced coma by people who I think have no idea what that means. And they've given no indication they understand what the consequences of that are.
Yeah, and Dave, you make a very good point on the revenue. This is something I've been talking about for some time now. And then I didn't know what the actual number was going to look like, but I knew there was going to be a big drop in revenue. Everybody's focused on the spending side, but you see revenue way down in all of the major revenue categories of the federal government: personal income taxes, corporate income taxes, consumption taxes, even customs duties and tariff revenue, which is not that big of a revenue source these days. So That is a huge issue. And again, if you look at history coming out of recessions, the revenue comes back slowly. It doesn't come back overnight. I mean, in theory, you could turn these programs off quickly, although in practice, I don't think that's realistic. But that doesn't mean the revenue is going to come back quickly. It depends so much on consumer and business confidence and a lot of other factors that are outside the government's control, quite frankly. So that revenue hole alone, if you just took all the spending away, you're still running a deficit of maybe $100 billion just on the basis of the revenue decline.
So stitching those two aspects together, so how should we be thinking about the state of Government of Canada's finances as people that are interested in government programs and government spending and defense in particular? So I guess it's kind of at least a couple of time frames to that. One is sort of what, given that there's limited information and a lot of uncertainty, but still a massive fiscal challenge, what's the rough time frame that we should be thinking about? Or is it too early to even have any kind of loose estimate on that? And what are the different kind of options available to government going forward right now in terms of how, in a big picture sense, we get out of that? And what is the impact of that mean for other federal spending? Ian, I'll start with you.
I think, well, first of all, on the timeline issue, I think you're looking at probably a two-year stabilization period for the budget where it'll be sort of 2 years before we can do any meaningful projections or have any clear ideas of what the fiscal impact of this crisis has been. That is, it will take to the balance of next spring and the end of the government fiscal year in March, and then another year beyond that. So if we have a budget or some kind of economic update in the fall, and then a budget next spring, they won't be any more probably reliable projectors of the future than the snapshot that we saw this week. And only at that point, I think, can you see what kind of fiscal management plan of the longer term is going to look like, that we're going to be feeling our way for 2 years and then we'll be on firmer ground for putting together a plan for the future. All of that said, the government's defense of its massive spending and the collapse of revenue and therefore this huge borrowing plan is the reason not to pull the fire alarm and panic about the house falling apart is that they're right. Interest rates are quite low. The Bank of Canada is supporting the borrowing program by basically printing money, as every central bank seems on the planet is doing for their national government. So for the time being, the consequences of this huge deficit financing are not going to be felt in the same way that was the case in the early 90s or in the 1980s, a battle against inflation when interest rates were quite high. So the interest payments on the national debt are not going to chew up the entire balance of federal spending. For that reason, I don't think there's any reason to imagine that the big capital programs of the federal government, and of course defense is the biggest one, there's no reason to think that the government has to axe those right away. There may be some rescheduling. There's going to be some rescheduling anyway because of supply chain problems for getting some of this stuff built. There may be some workforce problems as a result of the pandemic. But I don't think that the big debt piece, we're not going to feel the impact of that. That's going to be delayed through this two-year process as well. And so I think, contrary maybe to what I sort of expect Gene's going to say in a minute here, I don't see a two-year impact. This government seems to be remarkably unconcerned about the scale of the borrowing. If they are, they've kept it purely private. And they put out a plausible argument that with interest rates this low, I'm more worried about this than they are. But I'm trying to think through what their impact is. If there's no election in the next year, let's say, and they have an opportunity to manage through this two-year period of uncertainty, I don't see that they would necessarily feel they're under pressure to make any big changes on the big spending capital project.
Gene? Yeah, I completely agree with you on this, Ian. I mean, it's very difficult to forecast the future, obviously, but for a variety of reasons, I don't see any fiscal consolidation coming next year. If you read this fiscal snapshot, there's not even a hint of anything like that in there. And I watched most of Morneau's speech in the House, and he had one line where he kind of, forget exactly what he said, but he sort of alluded to the fact that at some point we're going to have to get back to some kind of a fiscal anchor. Now, part of that is the economy is just going to be too weak probably in 2021, even under the most optimistic scenarios, to start a deflationary policy stance. That's one issue. And then the politics of it. I mean, minority governments aren't typically enamored with fiscal austerity, especially liberal minority governments. So I don't see it coming, a fiscal consolidation or even an expenditure review process leading to that being announced, this fall or even next year. Probably more likely the following budget you might see this start to emerge. But that's not to say that officials within departments, particularly in Finance and Treasury Board, aren't looking down that path and starting to find ways to tighten things up a little bit. And I think that is a possibility in the shorter run. And as far as D&D goes, I mean, the deferral of some of the spending can be done in a kind of a technocratic way in a budget that most people don't even understand. That was done a few years ago, for example, in one of the budgets. Generally, I agree with the sort of time frame on this.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
How much of a factor, so just to build on what the two of you said, there's a ton of uncertainty, obviously, huge amounts of economic weakness. I think it's safe to say, based on the type of impacts that have been felt thus far under this particular economic recession, we're now seeing, just by virtue of the denominator shrinking, but the share of the public sector in the Canadian economy, the numerator in that equation, seeming to stay relatively static so far. How much of an argument do you think there will be to maintain public spending? And part of the reason I asked that question, having had the opportunity to finally get out and about in the last couple of days a little bit, I'm struck by how much downtown Ottawa looks like a ghost town right now, as the federal public service largely isn't back in the office. And so all of the commercial sector and the restaurants that have lived off that are suffering right now. How much of a role is there for public sector spending to at least continue on until we get back to some kind of period of stability? Gene? I don't expect them to snap into austerity mode next year. I mean, even if the economy starts growing, reasonably well in the third quarter, which is the optimistic scenario that they paint in the fiscal snapshot, you know, economic growth is going to be weak next year and uncertain, and we might go back into lockdowns. We just don't know. There's no historical, you know, precedent for any of this. There's no roadmap that they can use to suggest, well, this is how we've normally come out of a recession like this. This is terra nova for the government. There's no models that can really predict or project what's going to happen. So I don't see them snapping into any kind of belt tightening mode in the next year or so. But I would also say that a deficit at 14% of GDP is unsustainable. You cannot run a deficit of 14% of GDP for several years, I don't think. And the fact that they are trying to move people off of the CERB, which is the more expensive of the programs, onto the wage subsidy program, trying to get more people back into the labor market, is a sign that they're a bit worried about the spending profile in those two programs alone. I think the idea there obviously is we're going to reduce the total amount of spending on those two programs by moving more people onto the wage subsidy program and getting them off CERB. So, you know, I don't think you can conclude that they're not concerned at all about these numbers. They're eye-watering, and at some point there's going to be a reckoning, irrespective of this interest rate, low interest rate environment. You can't run a 14% of GDP deficit indefinitely. You know, keep in mind that the debt ratio has gone up 18 points as a percentage of GDP in the last 4 months, you know, from 31 to 49% or whatever it is.
Yeah, maybe I can offer a risk item to that scenario that Gene's just laid out here, because I think that's probably right economically, but there's a political dimension to this, and I want to flag that as a possibility. The government is in a politically precarious situation because it's a minority government, and some scandal can emerge at any point that could put the government's survival without an election at risk. We just don't know. Today's news has one. There could be one next week. There could be one in September. The political sustainability of a huge public sector that's taken no wage rollbacks, no furloughs, no layoffs, people working at home, but the output of government seems to be, you know, impaired or slowed down. So people aren't seeing the same kinds of services or turnaround times that they're used to, except for the emergency program. In an economy where there's massive unemployment in the private sector, where people have taken furloughs, wage cuts, wage rollbacks, job sharing arrangements, and so forth, in particular because of the piece of the workforce that's been hardest hit here, which is those folks in the kind of $40,000 to $70,000 a year range, they don't show up in the public news. They don't show up in the news programs because these people don't, you know, they're sort of overlooked by most of our political sources of information. There is the potential for somebody to go out there, tap into that, and turn that into a very difficult political movement for the Trudeau government to manage. They've been, I think, advantaged by the Black Lives Matter protest, Black, Indigenous, person of color issues that have been in the news of late. But at some point, if there's the impression that Ottawa, in the big sense of the term Ottawa, that the public sector is not paying, you know, public sector workers, public sector employees, public sector organizations, and organizations dependent on the public sector, have not felt the same pain personally and in a household way that folks in that more precarious end of the income spectrum have. Obviously, people who are making were making $25,000 a year, their income has been, as far as they've lost their jobs, been replaced by the CERB. That's not good, but, you know, that's probably, they've got a cushion there. The people above that chunk in the income spectrum, where the pain of this has been felt the most in the household sense. And that's out there politically waiting to be tapped into and waiting to be organized. And if that comes at a time where the government's survivability is in question, where there might be an election or where there might be some kind of political turmoil, that's the piece that worries me. Dave, I think if we come to that point, then the government has a different set of calculations they have to make.
And just to build on that, I think it's important context that the size of the public core public service has increased by several, I believe, tens of thousands, if not just several thousands of positions in the last 4.5 years.
Yeah, the workforce numbers so far have shown, you know, private sector jobs down and up and down and up. I mean, we're nowhere close to recovering the private sector job loss of the past 4 months, but there's some growth there and sort of a constant size of public sector employment in the country. But then again, there was no great loss of public sector jobs either. Obviously, there's been disruption in the public sector. I'm not saying that people in the public sector or the federal government haven't, had their lives turned upside down and so forth. But that income hit is coming to people in the private sector. And I'm not sure, spent 3 days in Ottawa this week. I didn't get the sense that that was an immediate and pressing concern for too many people in the Ottawa area.
So to contextualize this discussion about what might happen with different program spending or departmental spending of the Government of Canada, to take the actual end of year spending figures for 2018-2019, it's about $350 billion. Incidentally, almost exactly the size of our deficit at that projection for this year. But of that $350 billion, when you carve away things like old age benefits, transfers to the other levels of government, direct transfers to people through employment insurance, child benefits, and other programs, as well as public debt payments, you are left with, of that $350 billion, about only $100 billion of it that goes directly to spending by the ministries, which is, I guess, kind of collectively what gets described as being the discretionary pool of spending. And then of that $100 billion, national defense as of today would represent a little bit more than 20% to up to about 25% of what's left, depending on the year and the trajectory going forward. So to come back to the argument that you made in the paper, Gene, effectively, based on just the size of the defense spend, if you're looking to adjust government spending, you don't actually have nearly as big a pot to draw from unless you're going to take away grandma's benefits. You've only got $100 billion, to play with. D&D is about a quarter to a fifth of that. And then when you really start to crack that open even further and you look at how much of that ministerial spending is sunk and things like pension contributions, personnel contributions that are difficult to adjust with, D&D remains effectively one of the biggest sources of money for a government that wants to start pulling fiscal levers. And I guess from the conversation earlier, I think we're all sort of in agreement that just at least based on the revenue drop the government's facing, at some point, unless that is fully recovered, even just to deal with a reduced revenue stream, governments are going to be looking to tap into some of that spending. So with that, it's just kind of the context with the actual high-level arithmetic. Gene, what do you think is the prospect for a lot of government programs and defense in particular as you roll forward?
Well, I think that is exactly the issue. If you look back historically, let's say over the last 30 years, on government efforts to really, like serious government efforts to get to grips with a big deficit problem, they normally put in place a formal process of expenditure review. Sometimes it's called expenditure review. It was once called program review. It's been called deficit reduction action plan. It's got all these different labels, but it all amounts to essentially the same thing, although each of these exercises is typically carried out in a different way, depending on the government. But it usually boils down to that, as you call it, discretionary spending envelope that process looks at. That's what happened in the late 80s. That happened in the mid 90s. And it happened again in the, around the 2009-10 period. Ian can speak to that with great authority, I suspect. It boils down to that. Governments are much more reluctant to get into the statutory spending area. Now, that had to be done, or was done at least in the mid 90s, with tackling things like employment insurance. But that is an order of magnitude more difficult for governments to do, especially a minority government, by the way. So it boils down to that smaller pool. And as you say, DND's fraction within that pool has remained roughly static for the last 20 to 30 years, or usually between about a fifth and a quarter. And therefore, when you get into a process of expenditure review that looks at that discretionary spending, the Defense Department simply can't be excluded mathematically. A lot of people think, defense gets cut because of the politics of it. I look at it differently. I've always thought defense typically gets cut because of the arithmetic and is enabled to some degree by the politics. But, we've seen cuts to DND's budget by progressive, conservative, liberal, and conservative governments over the last 30 years. It's a bipartisan affair, and it comes down to that basic arithmetic. Now, I suspect you could ask most ministers, even in this government today, question, including maybe even the finance minister, when you get into a process of expenditure review, will you cut the defense budget? And I think most of them probably say, well, of course not. No, we wouldn't do that. We're committed to that. It only comes down, it only really comes to the fore when you get into a process of trade-offs. When you get into the process of trade-offs and you see how big this is within the overall universe of discretionary spending, that it becomes impossible to exclude. So again, I don't see an expenditure review coming this year or next year, but I do see it coming at some point in time. And when it does come, DND is going to be seriously implicated in it. In my view, I think the history bears that out, the arithmetic bears that out, and to a degree the politics enable it, because we know, and this has also remained roughly static for a long time in Canada, if you stack up the priorities of Canadians in any of these public opinion surveys that are done, and it doesn't matter when it's done, it doesn't matter if it's done during the Cold War, after the Cold War, before 9/11, after 9/11, whenever, defense typically is near the bottom in the ranking of a list of spending priorities. So that's the politics that kind of enables it. Ian?
I think Gene's piece for the Institute and his analysis of sort of three or four rounds of this is right. And I think the idea that somehow defense gets singled out because of somebody's, political priorities or lack of political priorities, there's a math, no department that spends 20 or 25% of the so-called discretionary part of the budget is going to escape a big fiscal consolidation program. So no matter what label you put on the cabinet committee that oversees this deficit reduction program review or whatever, it doesn't matter. Defense is going to be part of it. That having been said, the scale of this challenge, as Gene pointed out himself earlier here, we're talking about an economic setback, the size of which we have not seen in many, many, many decades, certainly in peacetime. The scale of this means that I'm not sure that this is manageable just on the fiscal spending side. This is why I said earlier, the government has to lay the groundwork now for a real burst of economic growth. The only way to get us back to some kind of sustainable fiscal situation. I'm not a deficit hawk. I never have been, but obviously, as Dean says, 14% is not sustainable quarter after quarter indefinitely here. The only way to get back to something that is sustainable is with a massive economic growth program. And this government has not had a very good handle on that since it was elected. If we're able to get in that two-year uncertainty period before we get to back to fiscal planning, multi-year fiscal planning, if they're able to put together a plan for really turbocharged growth of the economy, and we've seen it in the United States, over the last 3 years, maybe even a little bit more than 3 years, a big deregulation plan, a big tax reform plan, a big reform on the banking and finance sector side, that kind of extremely powerful economic growth piece is possible. And trying to manage this within the government, some kind of Treasury Board process for cutting a bit of spending here and cutting a bit of spending there, I think this is a bigger challenge than that. It's going to require a very powerful growth agenda. The governments who have done this in the past two rounds, in the mid-90s and then in the 2010-2012 period, had massive growth of resource sector, in particular in the energy sector, both times in the energy sector, as a result of government policy decisions in both cases. It doesn't look like we're going to have that this time to help with the economic growth side. So we're going to have to find something else. It's going to be harder to engineer that growth boost, but I don't see any other way around that.
Yeah, and I don't disagree. Look, don't get me wrong. That kind of a process that I described isn't going to solve this fiscal problem.
Right.
Neither did program review in the mid-90s. Program review, as draconian as it was, achieved a $9 billion annual savings optimistically for the government that was running a $40 billion deficit at the time. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying this is going to fix that problem. I think, maybe you can have some kind of miraculous economic growth agenda that no government in this country has ever been able to figure out what that policy framework might look like, but maybe we'll get to it this time. I personally think taxes are going to go up, not down, if any government's going to get serious about tackling this problem. But even with all of that, and maybe they will have to look at some point, some government someday will have to look at the statutory spending, as was the case in the 90s. hopefully not, but maybe. But even with all of that, I guess to the politics of it, I can't imagine that any government's going to say, oh, in the federal civil service and all the existing programs, they're protected here. We're not going to touch any of that stuff in this. Everyone else is going to pay. You're going to pay more taxes as Canadians. We might cut some statutory spending here and there, but we're not going to touch this discretionary spending. I just don't see it playing out that way. This is only going to be resolved through a series of strategic plays over time that are probably going to involve spending cuts, tax increases, and I agree with you, in some kind of growth agenda. And to get all three of those pieces aligned is going to be a very difficult challenge for any government.
I would just add to that that I think it's entirely possible that we could actually see statutory spending go up. There's a lot of calls right now and a lot of discussion about the universal basic income. Whether or not that particular mechanism would be utilized, I could figure you potentially put that aside, but I think most people would agree that the fact that the CERB was needed categorically shows that EI is, as currently configured, is not fit for purpose the way that our current economy is structured. So income support for people that lose their jobs, whether through pandemics or other things, has just been shown in the last 4 months to be completely inadequate for the way that our economy is structured. And looking at those other line items, well, the second biggest one of the transfers is to other levels of government. And it would seem to me in the current context that there's a lot of other levels of government right now that are broke, and some of whom have already had public instances of saying that they can't actually secure their own financing directly. So whatever that looks like in terms of the federal government providing some kind of assistance to them. On my read of it, it looks like there's definitely a scenario where, at least in the short to medium term, all that kind of statutory spending can't even just stay static, but it actually needs to increase.
I completely agree with you. This pandemic has shown what many of us have known for 20 years, which is the EI program is fundamentally broken. Successive governments have ignored that for 20 years. It's been well documented, well established. In Ontario, well before the pandemic, we know that EI covered maybe 40% of the workforce in a good year. And this has blown that wide open. So I don't know whether it's going to be a guaranteed annual income that comes into the breach here, as Hugh Siegel and others are pushing for, or whether there's going to be some kind of permanency attached to the CERB and for certain demographic, or whether they're going to open up the EI program and make the kind of fundamental reforms that are needed so that most of the workforce is covered by that. But I agree with you that we're not going to be going back to the status quo ante when it comes to employment support. I don't think that's going to be on the agenda of any government, and I don't think it'll be acceptable to Canadians, and it shouldn't be.
Ian, any thoughts on that?
No, I agree with all that. Yes. All I can say in addition to that is, in this, if I'm right that we have a 2-year period of kind of managing through in the very short term, it would be unwise to make any long-term changes to some of these programs until we have an idea of where we stabilize out the other side. Now, that said, as I said before, that this is a government that seems to be supremely unconcerned about what its borrowing is and supremely unconcerned about whether its fiscal policy is sustainable or not. So I expect there'll be some kind of big changes to something that looks like employment insurance in the fall. In particular, if there's going to be an election sometime in the next few months, they'll have something like that to run on. But I really, boy, for the longer-term plan here, I hope we can put off big changes to this and take a year or two to think about it and make sure we're hitting the right target. If we're going to reopen, she's right, we're going to reopen unemployment insurance, employment insurance, and try and fix some of the problems that we've known about for quite some time. I'd want to make sure that, we're going to do that once every generation, to make sure that we have that pretty close to 100% right. But I have a feeling we're going to move more quickly.
Okay. Well, thanks both for joining us to talk about this extremely rosy federal economic and fiscal picture going forward. On potentially more optimistic tones, as you're trying to get your minds off this, what are each of you reading these days? Gene, I'll start with you.
Oh, I just finished a really optimistic book. It's called The World in Depression, 1929 and 1939. I thought that I should reread, because I read some of it, I think, as a grad student, Charles Kindleberger's sort of seminal book on the Great Depression, to try and compare then to now. And I've just recently started another book I should have read a long time ago, John Keegan's book called The Second World War. It's one of the seminal books on the Second World War. I've read lots of books on the Second World War, but I hadn't read this one. So that's what's occupying me this month anyway.
Yeah,
I had on my list to read Tom Nichols' The Death of Expertise, which I think is about a year or two old now, about lamenting why we don't pay any attention to experts anymore. But I have been giving it about an hour on the plane ride back from Ottawa. I think I'm going to put it aside. It now feels like it was written about 200 years ago.
That's a good note on which to end. Ian, Gene, thanks very much for joining us in Defense Deconstructed. Don't melt in the Ottawa heat wave.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, thanks for having me.
See you, dude.
See you, and take it easy. Cheers. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. Our guests today were Eugene Lang and Ian Brody. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.